Therapy Insiders is sponsored by WebPT, the ultimate EMR. Why are they the ultimate? Well, one of the reasons is because they're going to help you with ICD-10, the transition to the new codes. You need to know it, and you probably don't know it as well as you should. Check them out at www.webpt.com/podcast to find out more about ICD-10 for a free demo and a lot more. Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders, part of the UpDoc Media family. I am Dr. Gene Shirakabrad here with Dr. Joe Palmer and Dr. Ersin Religioso. It's like a moon phase. Everyone is back together again, and it's kind of strange, but comforting all at the same time. How's everyone doing, Joe? Urs?
Doing well.
I'm doing well, Gene. It's super blood moon time.
I feel like people were posting crazy pictures about that, and that happened last week or a few days ago. I don't even know what day it is. I think it's someday, but I felt like people were posting crazy pictures, and then I go outside and I see like a little speck of something. I was like, what's the big deal about with that? Did you guys see like a big moon or something?
I saw it when it happened a few years ago, but truthfully, my 8 and 6-year-old stayed up later than I did. And then when I woke up, I found like backup pictures on my phone of all these blurry pictures of a big bright thing on a black background. So
sounds about right. We did see the eclipse when that was supposed to be going on. We did see the eclipse happen, which was pretty cool. But you know, usually either sleep through those or people post about it after it happened. Like, oh, did you see this really cool eclipse? You're like, oh, yeah, that was 20 minutes ago. You run outside.
That was kind of underwhelming for me, Gene. Sorry.
I'm glad I wasn't the only one. The eclipse was kind of cool, but it was just like everyone's posting like this amazing, miraculous thing that happened. And I was like, oh, it's the moon. You know, it's there.
Yeah. I find most eclipses are kind of underwhelming.
Well, I guess you see it once and you see it all the time. Speaking of seeing things once and seeing them all the time, Joe, you're seeing some interesting things right now. You're at a conference, right?
I am at the Maryland Workers' Compensation Conference.
Now, workers' compensation, that to me is an interesting topic that I feel like is always not really talked about a lot, but it's still a big part of a lot of practices. And I think workers' comp is a love-hate relationship with a lot of clinics. Would you say that, Joe?
Yeah, I think that it is a certainly a different mindset, certainly a different world in physical therapy that you need to be trained and work with in order to become familiar with all of the different players that are involved in a workman's compensation case. But I think it is a necessary part of private practice and having a payer mix that is overall sustainable for a practice.
Yeah, I think workers' comp, at least in New York, is a rather strange entity. I mean, I haven't had to deal with that in a few years since going cash-based, but in Buffalo, at least, in Buffalo area, I'm not sure if the rest of New York is like this. Say in Buffalo, maybe we would get 42 point something dollars per visit, but just in a different zip code even, you know, even still in Buffalo, but in a different suburb, they might get 45. In a different suburb, they might get 47. Then it's just a funny thing. Is it like that everywhere? Or is it just like that in New York?
I think those numbers might just be New York numbers.
Well, I'm not talking about, yes, I know in Buffalo it's abnormally low. Yes, we have abnormally low reimbursement, but I'm saying, is it by zip code? You know, do you get reimbursed by zip code?
No, I don't think it's that way in Maryland.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, like I said, it's been a while, but that's just my lame segue into transitioning someone with some interesting research on geography and back pain and surgery.
Well, that is an interesting segue. Another segue.
I'm not as good at segueing as Gene. Okay, people, I'm not.
This might be the furthest introductory stretch that we've ever done.
No, I think we've had further. It's building up. The anticipation is building, and the anticipation is worthwhile because the person on the end of this introduction deserves a very epic introduction. I think the build up, the slow burn, if you will.
Right. So, it's the irony, you know. I haven't done a bad introduction in a while.
Yeah, I think you should nail this one, Urson. So, all right, we got the slow burn burned enough. I think just go ahead and let's introduce our guest, Urs.
Well, we are honored tonight to have Dr. Tim Flynn of Evidence in Motion. You may be familiar with the clinical prediction rule for lumbar spine manipulation. And if not, you should be. It's one of the only ones that's validated. And thanks to Tim, we have that. And I want to talk with him about that and Evidence in Motion, what they're up to, future projects. So I just thought he'd be a great guest to have on. So we're honored to have Tim Flynn on tonight.
Yes, for sure. Welcome.
Well, thank you, guys. Thanks for that kind introduction. And I do listen to your podcast while running, and it's often I wonder what's more painful. in all seriousness, it's absolutely fun, and you guys keep my humor going, make my life easier out there on the trails and roads, usually trails. I look at the beauty and just kind of focus, but when out on the road, it's good to have you in the ear. So thanks for having me on tonight.
Absolutely. It's good to be to be one of the voices in your head. So Urson mentioned the clinical prediction rule. Just what is a clinical prediction rule? What the hell is it? What were you thinking when you created it? I mean, what? Why would you create such a thing? Why would you do that?
That's a great question.
Was that the intent?
Let's just get this over so we can talk about fun stuff.
Exactly. You know, let's just get it out of the way.
Okay. Yeah, it's fascinating. I do think a quick history lesson that we, you know, when I came out of grad school in the late 90s, I was basically became a recovering biomechanist because I got a PhD in biomechanics, but realized, well, it wasn't really helping me at all treating patients. And in fact, I knew less after I came out than I did going in about healthcare. And, you know, this big shift was happening with evidence-based practice, and I'm reading like, we got nothing, man. Physical therapy, there, you know, nothing works. The ACPR guidelines are out. The only thing that did work, our profession said, oh, we don't do it. Or well, they didn't say that, but they didn't fully endorse manipulation, which was one of the few things the guideline said, hey, has some benefits towards it. So that was the world I exited, and I was a bit disillusioned, and fortunately was able to, you know, get back in the clinic, get down to San Antonio, and like many great things, you just have great friends and mentors and colleagues that you stumble across, and really that stemmed really out of Pittsburgh, and Rob Wainer was doing his PhD there. I was working with Julie Fritz, and I was down in San Antonio in the military, and it was really one of those, well, people, everybody you would ask about in PT, or most folks, when you said, would you manipulate a patient, you would get a variety of different answers based on whatever their school of thought was, including myself. If we just took a single type of manipulation, lying on your back and doing a supine manipulation, which was actually been in the literature several times by both PTs and DOs, it had been published, a technique. You'd get a whole bunch of different reasons for doing that. I had some great ones because I would consider that technique only used for those that had a right on left or left on right sacral torsion or a right or left anterior innominate. And typically, if they had a standing flexion test, a Stork test positive, and had adaptive lumbar spine above it, so you wouldn't thrust through a non-adaptive lumbar spine.
Tim, you know Urson's head is exploding right now.
Oh, my ears.
He's bleeding out of his ears, much like yours are when you're running with us, probably.
So this is the world, you know, and I was as bad as everybody else. So basically what we said was, why don't we just, you know, do a really detailed history and physical examination and then just manipulate them all. And see who responds and see who isn't doesn't, and let's run it through an algorithm, which at the time was very rudimentary, and it's done differently now. But let's see if there you can determine responders versus non-responders. So that was really the key. I must admit that I was surprised by some that when it came out in the physical therapy community, I thought, you know, it would be a real positive across the board because it was published in, you know, a journal seen by a lot of physicians, and it was physical therapists doing spinal manipulation, you know, so from the perspective of, you know, just we were fighting turf battles as well with certain professions at the time. But many disagreed with what came out, and it wasn't what I predicted that, you know, again, that essentially things like, you know, acute onset low back pain, not having leg pain, or and some stiffness in the back seemed to be predicted. But a lot of those special tests that I thought were sacroiliac joint tests did not show any predictive value. So that was really the impetus of it. Then it went on. John Childs was at Pitt and did tried to validate through a randomized controlled trial. And then it was actually in at least a closed system at Intermountain Health. You know, what you would say it was actually put into practice, and that type of decision making does seem to make a difference in practice. So since that time, you know, it's been looked at, and there's been some studies like the Hancock study, which supposedly invalidated it. They really only used thrust manipulation in about 5% of that population. And so I think we can only say that what it does that particular technique coupled with, you know, a good history and physical exam and positive language, it does work pretty well in a small, relatively small subset of patients because of, you know, a lot of what we see are these with more chronic back pain and other types of things. Nonetheless, short-term effects of manipulation are there. And again, I think hopefully we got the conversation going with the study that was, I think we did. And we still know a lot less than we'd like to when it comes to back pain.
Well, you definitely got the conversation started. I mean, early in our career, so Joe and I went to school together, and, you know, early on, we took a manual certification course with Jim Meadows, and, you know, we would talk about the clinical prediction rules because it would come up all the time. And I was so against it. I mean, it would just, when somebody would bring up clinical prediction rules, it would just piss me off to no end because I felt like it was treating by the numbers. And then
he's not lying, Tim. He was adamantly against it.
Yeah, I was very much against it. And over the last couple of years, and just really thinking about it and just stepping away and, like, you know, growing and evolving, I realized it's not that the clinical prediction rules that I was really against. It was the people arguing for the clinical prediction rules, which is a big distinction, because people that use those rules, I think, create their own treating method versus really combining various components into a complete treatment. They followed those clinical prediction rules almost blindly. It was almost like a comfort blanket, which, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think that's what it's intended to be.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that I think on many levels that the rule should not have been used. But at the time, that was CPRs was a term that was used. You know, a clinical decision aid would maybe be a better term. I mean, just the word turned off a lot of people, and because it was, you know, and things like cookbooks would be said medicine. And frankly, we need more decision aids. I mean, we have no problem with, you know, actually my son just came off a horse. He's a professional rider today, and literally, you know, I'm like, he's on the ground with a friend there, and, you know, clearly it was pretty easy call, you know, he needed imaging based on the Canadian C-spine rules, but, you know, able to say, you know, do you really need to go? So clearly needs imaging. Question, do you need the ambulance or can you drive yourself there? And, you know, went through the neuro exam and whatnot. No, you can drive there, but let's get some imaging. And I'm waiting on the call back now. But anyway, it's so I guess I digress a bit, but these rules are helpful, or decision aids are helpful in making determinations about treatment decisions, but they can always be trumped by clinical judgment and an individual patient. And I think that's really the key, where, you know, anytime you blindly follow any system, then I believe that's a recipe for making mistakes, right? I mean, it just, clinical, to me, it's just part of the clinical decision-making process that you put into the mix. You start with that. But I hear people that would take someone with acute low back pain, no pain below the knee, and they still would say, oh, I wouldn't manipulate them because they're too acute, and say, well, have you ever had back pain, had somebody just like continue really kind of gently push there over and over, and when you want to just say, just move the damn thing and let's get on with the next part of care? And I think sometimes we've created too big of a thing, and at least in PT circles, about quote thrust manipulation, sometimes because it's been done not very skilled, or I always say it's a low force procedure. It's a precise procedure. It should be done in a in pain-free ways and comforting ways and empowering ways. But it's still it's one of the best things we got in our toolbox. So let's not underutilize it.
Right. I don't understand when people say I wouldn't do it or I'm afraid to use it. But in the end, I like what Dunning says about it: is anyone you would mobilize, you could manipulate as well. I mean, and people don't seem to say like, oh, I would never mobilize an acute low back pain patient or an acute, you know, mechanical cervical pain patient. So I'm not really understanding why, you know, it needs to be demystified so much.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing, because it's just we think it's lower load. And if you look at, like, say, the thoracic spine, older adults, repetitive, if you look at the summation of loads by repeatedly oscillating, you know, the actual load will be greater than what you might do with a high velocity technique. I do believe that, you know, the neck is an area of pause. I mean, we it's clearly the risk is a different risk discussion in the neck. I mean, you can read the data lots of different ways, but in the end, it's judiciously used. And I think that's patient values really come into it. There's been many more people, at least, in my experience, let me qualify this, but actually some data supports this as well. The irritability or side effects, meaning bad experiences or flare-ups, more common in neck than in the lumbar spine, at least the patients I see that have had bad experiences in other people's offices. Fortunately, most of them are not in our profession, but nonetheless, you know, I've had not so good experiences on the head and neck. Now, I think some of that is just, you know, the intimacy of, you know, hands placed on the neck. I think it's a very intimate thing when you place your hands on someone's neck. And I think the trust levels that need to be there, no matter what you're doing to the neck, it's a different ball game. At least that's just my opinion.
I think a lot of it starts early on in PT school as well. I mean, when you get your foundational start, then a lot of programs still, one, are not adept at teaching manipulation, but two, the neck is, you know, even though they might say, oh, this is an advanced thing, it's kind of laying the groundwork for the students to know, oh man, this is worse than manipulating the L-spine, or worse than manipulating the T-spine. And from that on, that kind of permeates through a lot of people's careers, and you create that stigma and that bias early on, and it's hard to shake, especially when, you know, a study comes out and might kill somebody.
I think that's a serious thing. That stigma, Gene, is a huge deal. And I think that PT's confidence with manipulation, especially from clinicians that may not have even been taught it as a tool when they were in school, is huge now, because people like Tim, the literature is coming out and supporting manipulation as a tool that is validated, and we have therapists that are afraid to participate and to use it.
Right. In the end, if you're not manipulating, or you're afraid to manipulate, or you don't think it's a viable treatment option, you can't really say you're practicing with a certain population with the best evidence. I mean, it's a quick tool. And if I had to choose it, if I had acute neck or low back pain, I always give my patients an option, but I can give them these options because I use both tools, mobilization and manipulation. You know, would you rather have me mash on it for 5 minutes in an oscillatory manner, or would you rather just have a quick stretch? I just call it a quick stretch. I try to make it as non-threatening as possible.
Yeah, very, very good point. And it is so true how our biases start very early on. And that's the thing that scares me the most as a faculty member, really, is, you know, am I creating biases in my students? And certain biases, you know, I will have to say I do. I mean, we just finished the first week of the lumbopelvic part of our first musculoskeletal series. And the students have already done all their lower core screen, basic PT exams, those types of things. But now getting more into the context of low back pain and, you know, just showing them the data. The data will make you biased when you look at spine surgical rates in this country. You look at the use of opioid in this country. You look at just the disaster we've created in low back pain. That's not a bias. That's like, you know, here's what the science says, and you better be aware of this. Now, it's how one interprets that. You know, they may say then that, oh, you know, I'll have students that surgery is never appropriate. And I'm like, no. That's not what we're saying. Again, it's not black and white in healthcare. You know, there's gray zones. But what we do know is things that don't kill you, we should be very slow in the decision-making process. If we're going to choose things that might kill you, why we try to help you. And that just slows that decision-making down. For instance, in lumbar spine surgery, I mean, the several studies, multiple studies now showing, I mean, the worst was the Washington, speaking of the workers' comp cases, the case control study of 750 in each group out there, where the people that ended up with surgery, essentially fusion surgery, vast majority never returned to work. Most were on opioid medications, addicted, and just horrible outcomes and serious outcomes. And even the more recent study by DeLito and colleagues looking at lumbar spinal surgery in the older adults, which they were decompression, they weren't fusion. And these were subjects or patients that were already going to surgery. So they're already saying, I'm hosed, I need surgery. And then they got randomized into either surgery or physical therapy. And you look at those lines and they're right on top of each other. No difference throughout early on out to 2 years. And yet there's a lot more side effects in the surgical group and life-threatening side effects. One more comment, I just say that, you know, given the opioid epidemic in the country, you know, I think it's sobering to realize 1 out of 4 of the folks addicted to opioid drugs started that addiction via a prescription in a physician's office. So 1 out of 4 we own because we started the addiction. And it's for pain. And musculoskeletal pain, the number one reason, back pain. Just absolutely absurd.
WebPT is the ultimate EMR for physical therapy. You know that. One of the reasons is because they know ICD-10, and I don't. So I ask Heidi Janenga, COO of WebPT. Heidi, what the heck is ICD-10?
Well, ICD-10 is diagnosis codes on steroids. We're talking more than 68,000 codes. All HIPAA-covered entities must switch to ICD-10 on October 1st, 2015, or face claim denials. That's where WebPT can help. Our intuitive ICD-10 code selector is built right into our documentation platform, thus simplifying the patient diagnosis process. I encourage all of you to check it out. Visit webpt.com/podcast to request a free online demonstration.
Yeah, if you could email me that reference, that would be great.
Yes, I'll be happy to send you all of that. I can send you a presentation on just in doing this, so it's fresh in the mind.
All right, so how do we present a cohesive, somewhat objective, not necessarily argument, but a case for kind of breaking through to the DPT schools, breaking through to still tons of practices that shy away from manipulation for whatever reasons or excuses they want to use, whether they think it's dangerous or they don't want to do the courses or whatever research they're reading from the 1400s doesn't support it. You know, how do we educate these groups or people or educational places to start actually incorporating it and teaching it?
That's a good question. I mean, the nice thing is at least from a regulatory perspective, you know, it's, you know, manipulation is to be taught in DPT level programs. CAPD states it, and it's in their criteria. So it is a criteria. So, I mean, have programs that aren't, first thing I would say, go to the source first rather than going to the accrediting commission. You know, just, you know, call the director and say, hey, you know, we've had your students in there saying that, no, they didn't learn how to do spinal manipulation in their coursework. Do you know that's a requirement for CAPT? I think those are fewer than and more far between. We've seen the data that's changed over the last decade. I have a lot of colleagues that, you know, the education spinal manipulation is very good in a lot of the DPT education programs now. So, and in fact, I mean, when you really look at it, the techniques, I always say when it comes to the spine, there's only a handful of techniques because basically it's how many ways can you put a patient, how many positions can you really put them in? There's just really modifications of those techniques. And as we get more skilled, it's not likely we learn more techniques. We get more ease and proficient with all body types, and we are better decision makers when it comes to doing the techniques and when it's appropriate. And really, more importantly, we're just better at communicating with patients and empowering them with our language while we're working with our hands. So, and that's why I think the skill sets, you know, from as we go through from entry level residency, certifications, fellowships, whatever, it's not like you're going to learn hundreds more techniques. In fact, it's really you're refining and becoming a better thinker. So I'm not sure if I fully answered your question, but I do think it's getting better in entry-level programs. I think the challenge in practice, we're seeing larger practices clearly get it. They see that if we're going to compete, our providers need to be trained and need to be consistent in what they get. So if they see therapist A, it's going to be fairly similar to if they see therapist D when it comes to common conditions, because that just drives, you know, your colleagues and referral sources nuts that, you know, you go to PT and you get, you know, 20 different thousand flavors of what physical therapy is for, say, something like back pain. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't have variability that's appropriate for the patient. But, you know, consistency would be that, yeah, you see a physical therapist, you get a very thorough examination. You get a very detailed history that they take. They place their hands on you for the most part. There's some exceptions on certain pain dominant patients. But they use manual procedures and they use empowering language and exercise. It's very, very active in the program, and they spend one-on-one time with you, and they're actually licensed. They're a physical therapist. They're not somebody that's, you know, has a poster on their door that's not licensed and is not doing what physical therapists do.
Yeah, Tim, I feel like that is part of the power of the clinical prediction rules, is to help people become more confident and more comfortable with manipulation. I feel like if anything, in order to bring people along, you have to tell them that this is certainly appropriate care for somebody that fits the criteria, and I think that that makes them feel confident in what they're doing, and I think that is the real power of the clinical prediction rule. Yes, Gene, I think that you shouldn't blindly follow a rule, but I think that as you become more confident with your skills as far as diagnosis, as far as patient preference, and as far as manual techniques, maybe you can make those decisions. But when you're unfamiliar or uncomfortable with manipulation, I think that having something that says this is validated, this is appropriate treatment for the patient that presents to you, just gives you the confidence to take that next step and go ahead and manipulate that patient.
Well, that's getting through mental blocks. It's if you have a mental block of I'm not going to do this until you have something that makes you feel comfortable doing it, then yeah, of course. But like Tim said, it's
but some people need that, Gene.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I think some people do need that, and if it gets them to the next level, that's perfectly fine. But I think the next level is once you start doing it, like Tim said, it's incorporating various things, clinical judgment, patient presentation, various techniques, various adjustments. What if you don't have every single one of the rules, but the patient still would benefit from it based on how you're setting them up and how everything else is working? You know, all that plays into it. And I think the biggest thing is the communication. It's you can't explain something to the patient that you don't feel comfortable yourself. You know, that comes through. And the same thing when you're setting up and doing something. If you don't fully feel comfortable or invested into it, you can't do it effectively. And knowing that and evolving as a clinician, I think that's the true benefit of it. And I think that's one of the biggest things with chiropractors is, yeah, they manipulate a ton, but people go seeing them with the expectations of getting manipulated. So they're going in there wanting that, knowing that that's probably what's going to happen. So their perception of what's happening is completely different. And
they also have a positive expectation that it's going to benefit them, and that's huge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And remember when Chad Cook was on, we were talking about exercise. It's almost analogous to that. Like we talk about exercise all the time, and PTs being the movement experts and the exercise experts, and then we start really talking about it and say, well, how good are we really at exercise? How good are we at strength training? How good are we at movement? We might be good at picking out abnormal movements. We might be good at knowing some exercises and knowing the different contractions and things like that. But are we really that good with really knowing how to load various joints and load various movements? And I think it's very similar with manual therapy. We talk about manual therapy all the time. But are we really that good at it if we're not utilizing it to what we can really do and be effective with it?
I think an interesting thing about, you know, manipulation to me is as much diagnostic as it is therapeutic. It's a way to go to an area, a related area, and quickly impulse that area and see if there's a change in symptoms, distal or proximal. So it's perturbation to the system. I perturbate it, then quickly go back to that provocative task and see if there's a change. And it, you know, though it may be temporary, it says, okay, there may be a contribution here. Therefore, I'll design that plan forward. And to me, it also is that idea that it actually, you know, it is a pretty good stimulus to that part of the system. So when you do go into exercise, it's like you tap there, especially in the chronic patients, right? We're seeing this loss of, you know, of tactile ability, discrimination in the back, loss of proprioceptive areas in the back in these chronic folks. So really, it's really stimulating the area to get them to feel it. I look at it as really, you know, manipulation is a neuromuscular technique. We still call it joint manipulation, and it's kind of odd, I think, I think what we're seeing now that's not the mechanism by which it works. But I think, again, it goes back to our biases of how we learned, because we learned about a lot of the techniques about pushing this bone on that bone. So we thought of it like we were in the joints, as if, you know, the joints are really the problem. So I think it's a fascinating thing, you know, how our biases develop that we all have based on kind of our initial training.
So let me ask let me ask you a question. You, Urson, and Tim, and Joe, actually, one of the biggest things that I hear a lot of times in against manipulation, or actually a lot of manual therapy, is the whole argument that it builds a dependency of the patient dependent on you because you are providing this relief for them that they feel like they need versus not really empowering them. Everybody's giggling now.
Yeah. Oh my.
Let's start with our distinguished guest.
Let me have a shot when you guys are done.
Go for it.
I'll go first. Well, I mean, I think one of the biggest things I tell one of my my patients, and this is because I have a bias in McKenzie, you know, even though I'm a fellow as well. And I trained with Stanley Paris, which was very passive. Is that you really have to empower the patient. And I basically tell them that no matter what I do, whether I, you know, I do a fast stretch, whether I get them doing repeated motions, whether I scrape them with a tool, in the end, all of those improvements are very transient, and they're going to be, I mean, if you want a quick fix, it's going to be quick. But if you don't reinforce it with some movement and some exercise, it's not going to last. And I think when you present it in a framework like that, it's one of the things I ask, one of the things I tell them. So I start that during the evaluation. I start that even during the history, and I reinforce it during treatment. And I also reinforce it again at the end when I'm showing them the exercises. Because once I do that pre-test, post-test, the post-test, they move better, they do a push-up better, they run better. They're like, great, how do I keep that? Well, you know, I'm going to show you how to keep that. And it's unlikely that it's going to last if you don't do these simple things that I show you. So I think it's up to the therapist, really. And it's really the clinician's fault, because every technique is passive and it's transient without the reinforcement from the patient.
Good statement. And I take an analogy, because I think sometimes that helps. So I had some gum disease, some loss of some gum, this about a decade ago. Probably went back to some poor brushing techniques a while ago, and had this area that clearly was not good. And, you know, I suppose the empowerment piece would have been saying, you know, that is a, you know, it is, you're going to lose that root over time. And, you know, if you don't change your behavior, but go ahead and change your behavior. I don't want to, you know, provide any treatment to that area, because that wouldn't empower you to take care of your oral hygiene. So therefore, I'm just going to tell you that it is in your power to improve that, that area. But, you know, I really don't want to enable you and basically become codependent with you on this, on your oral hygiene. So thanks for coming in today. I mean, it's just people come and they want some results. And I'm not saying we're acting, some professions say, I own you and I'll come in for two times a week for the rest of your life. That's not what we're saying. We provide some early care that is perhaps more passive, but even within a session, very empowering and active, as you mentioned. But to provide by laying on our hands and providing some relief and a window of opportunity to help someone, that there's something wrong and enabling about that. I just struggle with that argument, because again, there's not, I want to see the science that supports that. And I think we have, and I'm huge into the pain sciences. In fact, EIM is partner with Adrian Lowe and ISPI. And I mean, we are big into modern pain science. It's a huge area of interest for mine. That doesn't mean we just talk to our patients. It means we integrate in the new science into the management of our patients.
Right. When I hear people say, I'm a recovering manual therapist, and I know that they're into pain science, I just think, well, how could you give up manual therapy? I mean, to me, that just tells me you probably didn't present it that well.
Well, I think a lot of those people still say, well, I still kind of do it sometimes. I don't think, I've never heard anyone completely say, yeah, I never do it anymore. Most people, I deal with a little bit.
Yeah.
Manual therapy is not mutually exclusive to exercise. So, I mean, it's just, it's not doing manual therapy and sending them on their way, or continuing to bring them back time after time. I think that it's definitely a tool that you use, and then you have to use in conjunction with getting them moving again. And that's just a philosophy that is standard to me. I think that we can all agree on that.
Well, I think physical therapists, we the next big thing, instead of integrating and critically appraising, well, that's the next big thing, and then we go with it. It's just this constant, we constantly run through that. I think this is a good lead-in, actually, to this whole idea of dosing. You know, I think we underdose. What can happen doing manual therapy and exercise is, in certain populations, you may underdose both. And not be aggressive enough on either, and where being more aggressive on one or the other might be a better. That paper I saw came out ahead of print today, Haxby Abbott and colleagues, on they looked at booster sessions in addition to exercise for knee OA. It's just ahead of print today in JOSPT. I think I saw it today. But it was very, to me, it gets to more what I think are the interesting questions. We're beyond whether, it's frustrating to continue to debate whether we should be doing some of this stuff or not. And because it's like, didn't we solve this, you know, a decade or two ago? And it's fun to see like papers like this, where they basically said, you know, in these more chronic conditions, you know, yeah, you do need a booster now and then. You know, these are adults where basically we're preventing the need for knee replacement. And so it's okay to have them come back in 3 months and give them a booster session, okay, and maybe in another 3 months. And distributing the care over a course of time versus, you know, this window of care that's very narrow, if you will.
Right. I think that certain people feel like they are a failure as clinicians if they have a patient who needs maintenance. But I would say that certain people's nervous systems just aren't ready to accept change, or they need continuous novel input and continuous reassurance from, you know, a caring and empathetic clinician that could kind of keep their fear levels and anxiety at bay. Certain people just need maintenance, period. And I totally agree with that. I mean, every clinic kind of has their lifers, and whether they just enjoy it, I mean, I would say it's still better in surgery and drugs, that's for sure.
Well, you should know. Mr. Cortisone injections.
That was once, and it didn't work the second time, and I tried PT
the second time. Went back for more. You traitor.
Yeah, in the end, I fixed it myself.
That's what they all say. Yeah. I think it's, I feel like a lot of the contradictions, a lot of arguments come from absolutes. You know, people sometimes argue because for some reason their mindset is in an absolute. And I completely agree with Joe. It's a philosophy of adjustment. It's a philosophy of you know, clinical reasoning. It's knowing what's presenting in front of you with the patient. Sometimes they need a little bit more manual therapy to either desensitize them or just to get their guard down from being in pain constantly. And then you could do more exercise. You could do a lot of different things as long as you know how to do the different things. If you just close your mind off to just doing one thing, then you become a very limited clinician. Forget physical therapist, forget whatever. You're just a terrible clinician because you're closed-minded and you create a bias, even though you might be following research and science and whatever other excuses you want to use. That's still a bias, right?
Right. I think clinicians, and especially novice clinicians, you know, hashtag DPT students, you shouldn't really be looking for the next big thing. It's not manipulation, and it's not needling, and it's not repeated motions. It's you really need to learn when to apply these things and in what doses, and then learn how to read a patient and learn what patient preferences are. And some may really prefer manual therapy, and others may just prefer movement and they don't want to be touched. So it's not like there's a one tool fits all. It's just that anything can work for anybody, but not everything will work for everybody. So you just have to kind of learn through experience and trial and error when to use the right tool.
Unless it's the edge tool, because it's got a lot.
Unless it's the edge tool, because that just works for everybody.
It's got a lot of angles, and it just could fit anywhere.
So many.
Have you ever been stopped at an airport? Like, when you're taking courses, do you ever get stopped? Like, sir,
when I'm taking courses or giving courses?
Giving
no,
courses,
I've flown with like 50 of those things in the bag, and I just get asked funny questions, like, what are those things? I got, are they picture hangers? Are they ice scrapers? I never, you know, it's like, hey, they're massage tools. That's why I always wear, you know.
You ever tell them that they're ninja stars?
I wish I could, yeah. But I would probably be detained, or they'd be like, well, you can't fly with these. So I used to ship them, and now actually I just fly with them all over the world. So everyone seems to be okay with it.
So you say.
Right.
All right, so let's come full circle. Let's finish out with Tim. We started with clinical prediction rules. Let's finish out with clinical prediction rules. What's the future? Is there an evolution to them? Are you happy with the way they are now? If you can change anything, if you can just evolve it in a way, or would you just completely get rid of them at this point? What is in your mind with the clinical prediction rules?
Well, I mean, I, again, it's never a black or white issue in me. There's a number of rules. I mean, the Ottawa ankle rules, cervical spines rules. I mean, those are, you know, really robust tools for, you know, determining imaging and the like. I think in our area, I think clearly the challenges are they're best utilized for high volume early decisions, if that makes sense. So in other words, a tool like that is really designed for a first encounter or a second encounter that, you know, okay, this person's likely to respond. In our field, you expect that rapidly they're moving into another category of treatment. And though you may continue to do some, you know, manipulation, it's likely going to be, you know, more of a broader perspective in treating their entire musculoskeletal system, if you will, depending on, you know, the type of patient coming in. So I think we'll see, you know, an evolution. I think that perhaps I think we'll see them in some other areas, you know, trying to probably moving more to just the responder, non-responder. Maybe not. There's better ways to do the research now. So I think we'll see that. If I have to say what I'm most excited about, though, it's really, I mean, there's been so much great stuff on what we haven't talked about enough in physical therapy is really our behavioral skill sets and our, you know, positive interviewing skills and how we really engage patients. And I think most of us, if we look back at some of the great mentors we were with in clinic, one of mine was Phil Greenman. And what I learned most, I actually thought I was going to learn all these, you know, cool manipulations that I was actually teaching back in the 80s at Michigan State and to DOs, MDs, and PTs, the manipulation course. And I was the first PT to teach within the course. And Phil, he caught a lot of flack because, you know, bringing a physical therapist in to teach manipulation to DOs and MDs and the like. But that's just the type of human being he was. It was about doing the right thing and getting the knowledge out. And I give that little background to say, you know, he was a very skilled manipulator, very excellent teacher. So when in clinic, I really thought I was going to learn all these really the secret manipulations, right? And what I quickly realized, he did many of the same things over and over. And I was like, well, I know how to do that. I know how to do that. But if I would have saw that patient, I wouldn't have done that. And more importantly, I wouldn't have connected with that patient as quickly as he did. His emotional intelligence and patient interaction skills were phenomenal. And one of our interns was with me last week, and he came out and said, it was a chronic back, neck, and shoulder complaints coming in, a mid-60-year-old female. And we left the encounter, his first time visit, and he was sitting in, I was doing really managing the case, and he says, did you know that person? I said, no, that's the first time I met her. He goes, no way. And I said, well, yeah, you know, we connected. And he says, how did you connect that quickly and get to the heart of, you know, I was talking about some depression issues and some family issues she was having and getting right to the heart of the matter. And it was like, that was the benefit that he learned from that. And I think more and more we get that, right? Expertise isn't really, yeah, you got to be good with your hands and you got to be good with the choices of when to do these skills. But the big frontier is, how do we create that therapeutic alliance instantly? And because when you have that, we become the guiders that keep them away from some of these higher risk type stuff and give them another avenue towards health, which most of medicine isn't geared towards.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, we have to have a shout out to Larry Benz, of course, because until he was on the podcast, I didn't realize that you could learn empathy. I just thought that you were either empathetic or not empathetic. But, you know, I think that is one of the biggest things to learn. And it is all about the presentation and the interaction with the patient that is really going to kind of get you that alliance and improve your outcomes.
Yeah. Not only is he empathetic, he's a glutton for punishment. It came back twice.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
absolutely. But we'll have Tim on again if he wants to come back on.
No, I really enjoy it. And I think now is the time, though. My voice is a little off, so I need to go get a beer. So it's probably a good close.
Yeah, see, I drink beer while we're podcasting.
That's well, actually, I didn't want to mention that. I was. And I can't say what I'm drinking because I'm not drinking a local beer, which is unusual. So I'm actually drinking a low – well, I will tell you. I'm drinking a low-alcohol – Red Stripe Jamaican beer because I needed just something with little alcohol and a good like water.
So I'm drinking local to you. I'm drinking Blue Moon, actually. Okay. Isn't that made out in Colorado now?
You know, I think it is, but it's one of those big companies that we don't talk about. You know, we used to.
I know. I was so shocked when I toured that facility, and I was like, "Blue Moon is made here." It turns out that there is no microbrewery anymore.
No. So, but yeah, if you come out, we'll take you to the real ones. We now have, I think, 22 in Fort Collins, and you know, obviously New Belgium and Odell's would be the large ones. Both, you know, stellar community members and great people, and much like physical therapists, they're mentors, and they're mentors to young brewers and believe in, you know, the craft of the industry. And I think that's what I love about, you know, I'll leave very positively. I think we have, you know, we have passion in our profession, and we care about the future, and we really are trying to elevate our profession. So cheers to you guys for spreading the word.
Well, appreciate that. You definitely know how to leave on a positive note, start talking about beer. Everybody listening is definitely in a good mood now. And they're like, yeah, let's get a drink, except if it's Blue Moon.
You hear that, people? Tim Flynn says, have a beer.
Have a beer.
I agree.
Right.
All right. Awesome. Yeah, I think that was a lot of awesome information. And I completely agree with the last point. I don't think anybody can argue with that. It's making a connection with the person in front of you. And, you know, Jerry Durham talks about that all the time. The customer experience, getting their guard down, removing the hierarchy of clinician and patient, and having a genuine conversation with somebody, getting past all the wall stuff. And, you know, it's easier said than done a lot of times, but If you can achieve that, then the techniques a lot of times become a lot more effective.
You got to wear bright socks.
That's his secret. He does have some really bright socks.
David Butler.
Yeah, Jerry has a good selection of socks too. So he is
an animated character. We had fun at the next conference where we were watching a little bit of the Golden State Warriors basketball game, and Tim was there, Jerry was there, beers were there, and it was an entertaining experience.
Absolutely.
All right, Tim. Well, thanks so much for joining us, guys. Any closing thoughts, Joe, Urs?
No, I'm fine. You know,
work yeah, on your, you're drinking your beer. Working... Of course, you're fine.
Right. Well, I'm about to grab a second. So, yeah.
What about you, Joe?
No, I appreciate Tim coming on and talking to us about the clinical prediction rule.
Absolutely. Tim, so if our listeners want to find you, not that most of them should have any difficulty, where can they find you, look you up, anything like that?
Yeah, you can get me at tim at EIMPT.com, or you can, I guess, follow me on Twitter. I try to, when I put stuff out, I try to make it good, you know, but I'm not on there all the time. But yeah, I think at Twitter, I'm at Timothy W. Flynn.
Yeah, we can't all be at physical therapy, right?
That's right. That's a story.
Yeah.
No, that was a funny story. Yeah, if you haven't heard that story, definitely check out Larry Benz's first episode with us, where he told us how he's BFFs with the Twitter people and was one of the first people to get on and get a name. So shout out to him, and good for him. By the way, Jack back at SEO Twitter, in case you didn't see that. A little bit of current events, and doing the one thing that you should never do on a podcast is date it. So there we go. But details. So thanks again to Tim Flynn for joining us. Thanks for everyone that's been listening and following us on UpDoc Media. All the words of encouragement have been incredible. The emails that we get, constantly getting the reviews. We were in the top 20 podcasts in all of medicine on iTunes for the last couple of weeks, which is awesome. Thank you so much for that. And that's because you're downloading the episodes and really leaving us the reviews. So keep that up. If you know somebody that hasn't left us a review, hound them a lot, you know, constant emails, or just let us know. We'll do it for you. We got that on lock. So just let us know at the OMPT at Therapy Insiders, at Joe DPT, and of course, at UpDoc Media on Twitter. And we look forward to your comments and anything else, any other guests you want to know, just let us know and check us out on UpDocMedia.com. And we'll talk to you next time.
Check out the Garage series.
Oh, yes. I didn't mention that this episode. Urson is going to be the inaugural guest in the Garage series, a new continuing ed platform that we're launching via UpDoc Media. So we're going to be bringing in some of the best people, and maybe we'll talk with Tim and see if anybody from EIM wants to come through the Garage. Tim, I have a luxury garage, and we're going to be bringing in. Actually, I guess I can announce it now. Jeff Moore is going to be coming through here. Jeff, all right. One of the rising stars in the continuing ed community, and Jeff and I do mentorship for DPT students. We do an e-mentorship program, and he's an awesome guy, and he's an incredible clinician, so he's going to be coming through. So check that out as well on UpDocMedia.com.
Catered by Chipotle.
Catered by Chipotle, except Urson can't have any meat, so all the meat for you.
It, I'm just not going to.
So plenty of meat.
I'll give one final shout out to Manipalooza, which you guys would be great guests there, because it's music, beers, and manipulation. And
yes.
Jeff and I teach together at that, and it's just a pleasure teaching with him.
Is it in that order? Because that would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, there's been known to be work done on the bar, yes.
Nice. So. All right. Yeah, I plan on making. Every time I see that announced every year, I just think, that looks awesome. So,
well, we have audio evidence. I'm considering that in official invitations, and I'm coming because of that. So. Right.
We're just going to show up.
All right, so check out Manipalooza. We'll be there now. So we've been invited, and we're going to go drink and manipulate.
Manipalooza 2016.
Woo!
Sounds great, guys.
That sounds like a live cast to me.
Right, that's right. Manipalooza 2016.
That's right. Cavitations for everyone.
Nice.
thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.